it.
Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. SDPB helps you get ready for the landmark documentary event, the Vietnam War. You can find our continuing coverage and information about events in your community at sdpb.org/Vietnam. Today, we welcome Adrian Hannes to tell his story. Hannes is an archaeologist and professor at Augustana University, but he also served in the United States Army as an intel officer. Adrian, welcome.
Yeah, thank you very much, Lori.
It's your story. All these stories when we talk Vietnam are so vast and so deep. Sometimes it's hard to figure out where to even begin.
True.
Yeah.
Very true.
Let's start with the sole surviving son aspect of this, because you were exempt from Vietnam service, but you didn't know that.
Tell me that story. True. I guess it demonstrated to some degree the naivety of my mother and I, who, whenever I entered the university programs, you know, the draft was in effect, and so the choice that was given to us by, especially by the propaganda of the ROTC departments, was that wouldn't you rather be in as an officer and a gentleman than be in as a draft, you know, draftee? And I mean, it seemed like a reasonable enough argument, so I signed up for. I was at Wichita State University campus, so I signed up for the Army ROTC and chose the military intelligence branch as my branch. So in any case, I went through the program there. And of course, in signing up for the program, there was no doubt what my status was as far as being a sole surviving son. My father died when I was 8, and they certainly had all those records, because my father was from France and came over to set up the food exhibits for the 1933 World's Fair in Chicago, and later met my mother at the fair and later married, and so was a naturalized citizen, and I had to come up with all of that documentation whenever I was entering the military. So in any case, following graduation, I went to law school on a delayed active duty, and then that later was canceled, sent over to take in a friendly Southeast Asian vacation package that the government was providing us with. And so in doing that, I guess that my mother was just overwrought and talked to a couple of people, including finally someone directed her to one of the U.S. senators from Kansas, who said, well, you shouldn't be going, you're a sole surviving son. But the answer of the military, of course, was, well, no, you volunteered because you signed the paperwork to get your commission. Well, of course, so it goes back to unraveling this idea that the people who were recruiting for the ROTC, you know, cared little or no part at all about whether they were taking away something that you could have been told very simply up front, right, that there's no reason that you need to serve. So anyhow, all of that aside, I guess that then I went over in ultimately in July of 67 and came back in July of 68, so I was there for probably the high point of both military presence, and of course that was the 1968 February was when the Tet Offensive occurred, and so it was a, you know, it was a, and I was, when I got to Vietnam, I was reassigned to a program that was part of the broader Phoenix program that the Central Intelligence Agency was created, and I don't know how many of the, you know, listeners are familiar with the Phoenix program, but it was a very broad-based counterinsurgency program. There was just one dimension of it that I came to be involved with, and it was created at the very time that I was arriving there. They took some 240-some plus of us who were same junior officer grade and put us into the various Vietnamese districts scattered across South Vietnam. In the four core areas, there were provinces, and then those provinces were further divided into districts. And the districts had a military component that was sort of like a home guard, I mean, if you were trying to describe it. So we were put out to formulate what were called the District Intelligence Operation Coordinating Centers, or the DIOCCs as the acronym. And those were supposed to be instructing the Vietnamese in creating dossiers, much like, for instance, our Federal Bureau would do here on individuals who were of interest, especially in that case, supposedly of either interest as being Viet Cong or North Vietnamese, you know, connected cadre. And then we were supposed to build these dossiers and ultimately then target these individuals to be assassinated. So I and all the other people who went out in these roles were given a team of 20 Vietnamese who had been taken out of some of the prisons in Saigon, and our Central Intelligence Agency had taken these folks to Guam and trained them as assassins and then brought them back into the country. And so basically the program that I was connected to was a CIA-based program, and I was supposed to be answerable, as were all of us, to the CIA. At the same time, we were sent for our support to these district compounds that had military advisory teams, which were our first entry into the engagements in Vietnam, creating these advisory teams that had been there present for quite a number of years already. But so these teams were made up of a major second or first lieutenant and three or four enlisted people, U.S., who were then advising the district chiefs, who were Vietnamese, and the district chief's cadre of, you know, military people. And so at the time that I went out, it turned out, coincidentally, that probably no advisory team in the entire country had their junior officers. So we arrive on the scene, and the friendly major says, "Well, you're my new infantry, you know, junior officer." And I'm saying, no, you don't understand. I'm the friendly intelligence officer, and, you know, see, I have this intelligence brass on my uniform. And he's shaking my uniform, saying, "This is the Army, you know, and this is an Army uniform, and you're here as my friendly junior infantry officer." So this whole program, you know, got off the ground very poorly, let us say. We had no training in language. We had no training in any part of what gathering data to create dossiers would have to do. So, in fact, my intelligence training was very inadequate. It was just a one month instructional period at Fort Holabird in Baltimore. I had done a 9-week training in the infantry school at Fort Benning and then went to intelligence school. And so we were really not, and then to go over and be presented with being part of this program that had no real definition to it was certainly ill-conceived. And I suppose that, especially now that I'm a practicing anthropologist, you know, in deep hindsight, the U.S. was certainly not prepared to be engaged in that particular area of the world. They really didn't understand the culture. And of course, at that time, the conflict was probably an economic and political conflict. The conflicts that we have found ourselves embroiled in more recently have even a more sinister dimension to them, I think, because they're, you know, political, economic, and religious. And again, I think we have very poor understanding as far as the way in which we implement our programs as to, you know, what would instruct us in a valuable way as to what we should be doing in some of these parts of the world. But in any case, of course, Vietnam also left a legacy that was an odd legacy, because we who were involved in that whole embroilment came back to a country that was severely divided over the war and over many other issues. But it's certainly, you know, a very tumultuous time in the nation's history. And coming back, I think most of us, I know I found myself getting off a plane at Travis Air Force Base, and the first thing that happened to me was I was just walking from the plane to the hangar where we were going to be processed to get planes to our various hometowns to take a month's leave. And I had a colonel pull me out of line and say he wanted to see the orders that I had allowing me to wear the combat infantry badge, because I was a intelligence officer and I wouldn't be deserving of that badge. And so I had to go through my paperwork and show him that, you know, I think the fourth day in country, I was in a very brutal firefight, and I think I logged about 197 of those engagements while I was there, not that anybody was counting. But so that was fine. So I got my plane tickets for the next day, and a couple of fellows that I had been in San Francisco with before we left for Vietnam happened to be on the same flight with me. And so we thought, well, we'll get a hotel and go have meal in a restaurant that we had eaten in San Francisco before we left. So we got a cab driver who took us into the downtown area, and we went to the hotel that we had stayed at, a year earlier. And one of us went in, I can't remember which one, but anyway, we were told there were no rooms. And so this fellow started driving us from hotel to hotel, and he had said nothing particular. And finally, after about the sixth hotel that told us there were no rooms, he said, you know, these people are really jiving you. There's nothing going on in San Francisco. It's because you've got uniforms on. He said, does anybody have any civilian clothes? Well, our civilian clothes had fairly well molded and everything else. But one of the guys said, well, he had some in his, bag. So this fellow took us to a service station, and my counterpart put on his civilian clothes, and he only looked like he had been dragged behind a dump truck for about 6 or 7 or 8 or 10 blocks. Let's say he was somewhat unkempt. We went back to the original hotel that we had gone to. He went in and got us rooms. So, in other words, so this is 4 or 5 hours into this return to the United States, and then, of course, it became more intriguing as it went on. And I guess that has to be what happened to many, many of the people that came back. And I'm sure that's why, we have all the people suffering from, various types of post-traumatic stress syndromes and so on. And I think, to a large degree, many of the people that I've met over the years who are in Vietnam have chosen not to talk about their experiences at all. I think I've probably spoken about them more than some, only because when they described Vietnam as the killing fields over in Southeast Asia, it certainly was that's not in any way an exaggeration. It was, the carnage was unbelievable. And I was one of the people that, for instance, I think I had never seen anyone badly even injured in more than cutting their finger or something before I showed up over there. And on the first time out, several days after I got there, we killed several people, and in the ensuing year that I was there, there were people that were dying right beside me. So, and I was sent out. These assignments that we had to these district intelligence centers included, we were going to gather information for the folks in Washington. One of the things that had been being charged was that the body counts were not accurate, so they started sending officers out, of which I was one. So after any of the engagements that happened in our district, I, on a number of occasions, like at 3 or 4 in the morning, was dragged out to some of our outposts that had been overrun, and I was supposed to make some determination as to whether there were any bodies or parts thereof of, the enemy. And so went out and did this, which was certainly quite gruesome. Came back, and after the first couple months of turning in these records, we started getting printouts from the center in Saigon that was called CDEC, which is what was amassing the records. And I went, looked up my district, and I thought, oh, these don't look like the figures that I remember sending in. So I went back to my filing cabinet and looked up, well, what did I send in for number of individuals that, I counted physically parts of. And I noticed that the figures didn't match. The figures that were in this report were greater than the figures I had sent in. And then that set up a pattern, because each month as I was submitting the figures, a month later I'd get the readback of all the districts in the country, and in looking mine up, it continued to be, just an exaggeration of what I had turned in. So when I went finally to Saigon for the day before I flew back to the United States, one of the fellows I knew who had been stationed at that center in Saigon and had been doing these data processing exercises happened to be someone that I ran into. And I said, you know, I'm just curious, honestly, because these figures are supposed to be generating a correct approximation of what number of people are being, you know, killed during these engagements that are the enemy. And I said, my printouts always came back with exaggerated numbers from what I had sent in. He said, well, you know, the thought process, though, that drives this is that if you went out and counted three people or parts thereof, we know that the enemy, as well as ourselves, try to recover our dead and wounded. So when it went to the next higher headquarters, as your report went forward, they'd say, well, you know, if three, well, we'll make it six. And then it goes to the next higher headquarters. So, of course, I'm being facetious, but before this was all over, we had probably killed most of the population of the South and half of the population of the North, but the people kept coming. And, of course, then we have the Tet Offensive, which, you know, was sort of the Waterloo of the entire exercise, I guess, because from that point on, at least where I was, our compound was under attack, as most were, and it turned out that when the attack was finally broken, if that had been a fully coordinated attack with all of the different installations in the country being attacked simultaneously, I'm not sure that we would have come out making it through that particular program. However, there was enough of a time lapse between some of the attacks launched against different bases earlier so that we were under attack for about 14 hours, and we finally only were saved by some helicopter gunships that we managed to get to support us from one of the near U.S. bases. And it turned out that when we counted the ammunition that we had amongst us in the compound, I think we had about 400 rounds total, which would have been like a millisecond, okay, because the way you went through ammunition, it was so it was a pretty grim situation. And then from that point on, I actually, in the compound I was in, we never slept at night again. We sort of slept off and on during the day, because we kept thinking that there was another attack coming. Of course, you know, again, looking at it in hindsight, realized that it was the carnage inflicted on the Viet Cong and North Vietnamese was massive. And of course, they were waiting for us to counterattack. But instead of counterattacking, it was the perception on the part of, you know, our structure that there'd be another attack coming. And so it was it was one of those situations where it certainly changed the dimension of the engagement from what was happening, although we continued to go out and run operations and certainly had a lot more firefights before I departed. So
we're going to take a quick break and come back and talk more with Adrian Hannes. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to In the Moment on SDPB Radio. We're talking about Vietnam stories. You can see many of these stories at sdpb.org/Vietnam. More with Adrian Hannes after this break.
Army today.
Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We're talking about Vietnam. My guest today is Adrian Hannes, a Vietnam veteran. He's also an anthropologist, archaeologist at the University of Augustana, at Augustana University, I should say. Adrian, I'm curious, as an anthropologist, knowing what you know and studying what you've studied over the years, how important is it to tell the stories of a time like the Vietnam War? How important is it to record them, pass them down? Is that something people do throughout history?
I think as far as, you know, in the deep time of prehistory and history, stories really are, because we are, we're an organism that is wired to be a social organism. And storytelling, I think, is really the essence of the way in which things are passed from generation to generation, lessons learned or not so much learned. because, of course, what happens with any of these military circumstances, it seems to me that they run in cycles. So you get, you know, the memory fades about, say, Vietnam, and the next thing we find is that we're wandering into another set of engagements that have many similarities to some of the same problems that underlie the situation that we were involved in Vietnam. But Vietnam was probably particularly distinctive in that the way in which people that were involved in the conflict, like myself, felt whenever we returned to this country. And I mean, I had no illusions. I was really quite opposed to a military intervention in Vietnam before I ever arrived in Vietnam. And being there only further substantiated my deeper feelings that we were not doing the right thing in the right place for the right set of reasons, and the reasons that were being presented to the public for our engagement there were, I think, quite distorted. I mean, we were supposedly, you know, fostering democracy and stopping communism or something, but probably to a greater degree it was the interest in the oil that was under the South China Sea that was driving it, or the interest of the military-industrial complex for continuing their adventurism. But all that aside, it's a situation where if you don't tell the stories, then you really have lost a major dimension of human consciousness, which we so critically need, because human cultural systems are totally based on sets of understandings as far as, you know, within the members of a particular culture. There has to be some kind of a base of, I think, homogeneity to the messages that are being moved across the system, so that you get, let's say, for some strange way of saying it, you get all the actors on the same page. And when you have as much divisiveness as we've had, say, flowing forth from Vietnam and certainly in the current period as well, there's so many different sides to the debates, and the sides become so solidified in their positions that you're not any longer hearing the essence of what we should be talking about, which is trying to hold the structure together. And of course, as the friendly archaeologist, I'm looking at a deep time story, and that story is littered with failed systems. There's no doubt about it. I mean, culture doesn't have any prescribed direction to it. It's a very random process, and you have decision makers taking you to different places, and you have populations either following or not following those decision makers. But there are points in time, and it's certainly very eloquently documented in many past cultures of the world, where those systems imploded, and they frequently imploded because of internal bad decision making rather than external hostilities and so on. So thinking about that as an anthropologist, I try to, you know, in my lectures and so on, get the students to just think about, well, we aren't moving in a particular set of directions because there's some predetermined blueprint for that. It is a very random process. I mean, that's something that I think most cultural anthropologists would agree with, that kind of a perspective. At least many would. And I guess that the evidence is extraordinarily on the side of that argument, that we need to have, rather than responding to things in the very shortest time frame, we need to have some kind of greater thought process informing us on what all the, you know, what are going to be the consequences of the next set of actions. And it's the consequences that just don't seem to be very well thought out. And of course, today, as you well know, the news cycle is such that things are happening absolutely with an intensity that they've probably never been reported on previously, and it's also the case that the decisions that are being made are being taken in a lot of cases very rapidly, with really not sorting out, well, what are really the long-term potential implications of this. So the Vietnam stories, I think, are critical. And of course, since we were received so poorly when we returned to this country, in so many instances, I think most of the folks that I have talked to over the years who had the same, similar, some kind of experiences in Vietnam that I had, that we all had, probably tended to bury a lot of that information, feeling that either no one wanted it, or, you know, that it was something that it was just an embarrassment that we were involved in it in the first place. But so at least it's improved to some degree that people that are now serving in our various expeditions around the world, I hope, are being treated with a little bit better level of respect, although at the same time, you get comments like, thank you for your service, and so on. And I'm always bothered, not by the, you know, comment being something that isn't sincerely stated, but I think that it's got a certain level of shallowness to it that really doesn't take us to where we probably really should go in reflecting on what this meant. And I would certainly hope that this major piece that Ken Burns has been working on, when it comes out — Burns has been very good at capturing in his past pieces many of the more subtle and nuanced parts of these stories, for to either the positive side or the negative side. And, you know, in this case, Vietnam, I think, will never be able to be pooled into any kind of a framework where we'll be able to say that this was an admirable thing for us to have done. And I would not expect Burns to be doing anything other than trying to get us, you know, as tight and as neutral. And of course, there is — neutrality is one of those very slippery qualities that very hard to get your arms around, because we're neutral, but we always are tainting the story with our own biases and so on. So yeah. Anything that I think about what happened to me has certainly a very strong set of biases built into it, even though I've tried to erase some of that. So
the Ken Burns and Lynn Novak documentary is called The Vietnam War. South Dakota Public Broadcasting Television airs that in September. Between now and then, we're helping you get ready and process not only the story, but the events of Vietnam and how they impact our lives and our state today. You can find those stories at sdpb.org/Vietnam. Adrian Hannes, I hope that you will come back and talk to us again about Vietnam, maybe during the week of the Ken Burns documentary as we see it, and sort of help us continue to process it.
I'd enjoy that very much.